So the reading is Daniel chapter 6, which is page 898. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps and to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account, so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and the satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Then the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault, because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we can find it in connection with the law of his God." Then these presidents and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, "O King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors, are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into a den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document, so that it cannot be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked." Then King Darius signed the document and injunction. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house, where he had windows in the upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making a petition and plea before his God. Then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, "O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into a den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing stands fast, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked." Then they answered and said before the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day." Then the king, when he heard these words, which was much distressed, and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed." Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." And a stone was brought and laid at the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Then, at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. And as he came near the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm." Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian.
Ellie, thank you very much indeed. Please keep that open. And I wonder if I could offer you Daniel's choice. So if you had to choose your quiet time to read the Bible and pray with God in the morning or death, which would you choose? I wonder. My more normal choice is to choose between a few extra minutes in bed and getting up into a cold house to pray. And that can be a hard choice, but can you imagine ever choosing death rather than miss your quiet time? That is Daniel's choice, and it is quite something. So again, in Daniel, we are in a scary world of dramatic choices and megalomaniac political systems. Daniel, he had a government job with the most powerful nation in the world, and last week they were conquered. English people aren't good at imagining this because it only happens to us in the rugby, but imagine if it was November 1940, and Hitler had succeeded in crossing the Channel. Or in precise detail, actually, it's as if General Rommel had crossed the Channel and was waiting for Hitler to be free to come and be king of England, because Cyrus is emperor and Darius is king of Babylon. Though actually, even without the regime change, these are scary kings to live under. It's as if one of the baddies from James Bond had actually managed to take over the world. They have furnaces to cook people and a pit full of lions. Just imagine how expensive it is to maintain a pit full of lions. Someone's got to catch them, someone's got to breed from them. I understand your vets are away, but they'd know how much that costs. Someone's got to keep the cages in good nick so they don't get away. Someone's got to keep them healthy with their teeth all sharp, and you've got to feed them just right. So you've got to keep them hungry, but not too weak either. So scary, scary world. And in terms of the Bible storyline, we've crossed a very, very important dividing line. I've put on the handout in the sheet there, I've put that we are now in the era of the not us kings. Here's what I mean. So lots and lots of the Bible has been about Israel getting the right kind of king. So Moses operates a bit like a king. The book of Judges says we really need a king. Saul was the wrong king. David was the right king. And then David's sons are either good kings or bad kings. But the goal is always Israel with a king. Until Daniel chapter 1. And from now on, the people of God will always have an overlord. Ezra and Nehemiah have the Persians. Herod has the Roman emperor. And we have David Cameron and Nick Clegg. And just think what a change that is for God's people. From Daniel chapter 1 until the second coming of Jesus, there is no more independent kingdom for the people of God. No more setting things up your own way. So this book is to tell us how to live in those days. And sometimes the overlord is awful, Belshazzar and his blasphemy last week, but sometimes the overlord is nice. So Darius the Mede is a nice, not us king. But when we're in that situation, if Queen Elizabeth goes on TV and tells the world to believe in Jesus, that is great. But just in case we're tempted to think that because of that everything is okay, we have Daniel chapter 6. See, Darius really, really likes Daniel. He is a very nice, not us king. So Daniel, he's had years of disappointment and retirement. He's had to face down Belshazzar, but 6 verse 2, Darius promotes him. Then verse 3, he promotes him again, and that is not just politics, because verse 14, verse 18, verse 19, the king cannot sleep when Daniel is in danger. He's a really good, not us king. So how is it that in the first year of that king's reign, Daniel has to choose between his quiet time and his life? See, Daniel is faced with a new king, with all the power of an absolute monarch and all the problems of someone who's pushing through a multi-billion pound takeover. And at first, things go brilliantly. And Belshazzar, he thought he could make Daniel third most important man in the kingdom, but Darius really can. And Darius promotes him. And you could see why he'd want Daniel in his government of all the talents, can't you, in the tricky first year after the takeover. We know from history that the Persians kept on lots of Babylonians, that the Babylonians welcomed them as they came in. Cyrus worked really hard to keep them on board. So Daniel, the old prime minister, he is ideal. And actually he is 70, in his 70s, so if it doesn't work out, you don't have to wait too long to replace him, which obviously couldn't happen today at all. But our story, that's a Pope joke, sorry. Our story is all about a trap that happens to Daniel while he's in the land of the nice, not us king. So point one, we're going to set the trap. Do you remember, this is what happens when the king is nice. What happens is the establishment responds to believers in favour. What do? They plot to kill them. So when Darius announces that he's really keen on Daniel, he's not just going to be one of the 120 satraps, he's not just going to be one of the three presidents over the satraps, but actually, verse 3, we're going to make him the super president over everybody else. That is when the other 122 have a problem. And maybe it's that Daniel would have cleared out their corruption, maybe there's some racism in it, but it's presented mostly as pure envy. But they have a tactical problem, because even the illegal phone taps cannot catch Daniel doing anything wrong, which is impressive, isn't it? Daniel has been in government all of his life, but there is no complaint, no fault, and no error. But they have a way to get him. They have a way to get him. They have a way to get any one of us, believers in Jesus, because, verse 5, he really loves his God. There's his weakness. Their plan is in verses 6 to 9. It is a breathtaking piece of flattery and hypocrisy. They offer Darius the chance to be God for 30 days. Whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Maybe Darius sees this as a way to test the loyalties of his newly conquered city. They were quite kind to other religions, the Persians, but you want that to be secondary, don't you? Primary loyalty, the government. Secondary loyalty, anything else. Again, I think it is the same thing today. We'd love you to be religious in the same way as we'd love you to be keen on football or keen on cinema. Fine to be religious, particularly if we can find a way to tax it. That's superb as your secondary loyalty. But if you have to choose between your religion and the fundamental values of our society, then you had better not choose your God. So they set a trap, and it's a trap that could only catch somebody who is prayerful, honest, and brave. Nobody else is going to get caught, only Daniel. And the Bible is trying to teach us what it will be like to live in the period after the kings of Israel and before the global rule of Jesus. Even under nice kings, there will be envious enemies, and they will be sneaky, 122 competitive politicians, all work by agreement. And it will all be legal. Did you notice that? There are lots and lots of different ways to get the people of God into trouble. You can do it openly, like chapter 5, or you can write a sneaky law. I think we mustn't be naive. The rule of law will not protect us. Courts and lawyers will not save us. Democracy does not guarantee freedom of religion. Even democracy is just rule by not us powers, just 45 million of them, the ones that bother to go and vote. See, even in a nice king, Darius is my bezzy mate situation, you can get into real trouble very quickly, and you'll need to decide whether God is your primary loyalty. So let's look at Daniel's decision, verse 10, how believers respond to the plot. And that you've got to assume up to verse 10 that he has been in the palace trying to prevent this law from passing. But verse 10, when he knows it is too late, he goes home, he kicks off his shiny black work shoes, he puts on his slippers, he gives the dog a biscuit, and then he goes upstairs. And you've got to say, why not stay downstairs? The cellar would be good, cellar is nice. And he goes to his highest, most visible windows. And that is not a good idea. And it's the ones that face towards the ruins of Jerusalem. And Daniel, that is too obvious. Everyone knows that's where your religion is based. And then he gets down on his knees and you think, stupid, everybody knows you can pray sitting down. You could hold a magazine on your lap. Nobody needs to know what's going on. And he prays 3 times a day. Now, at least make it hard for them. At least make them get up in the morning as he had done previously. Isn't that impressive? The global superpower has made a new law, but there is a higher law that he has been following for 67 years, so he changes nothing. This is a trap that could only catch someone prayerful and honest and brave. But I think Daniel actually goes beyond their hopes, isn't it? This is stunning integrity. He's in their face, taking them on, disobeying their law. Courage. Isn't this what the entire world wishes their leaders were like? And this is the reason that Aung San Suu Kyi and Nelson Mandela are revered the world over, and Tony Blair isn't. This is utter, total, brave integrity. I wonder if Daniel ever asked God why God had sent him to work all his life in the Tower of Babel. You know, I wonder if he ever said, anywhere else in the world, God, would be an easier place to be a Christian. But actually, he avoids all of our mistakes. So he does go to work for them, rather than trying to separate off into the pure people of God in a corner somewhere. And he always knows that his situation is fragile. There's no foolish overconfidence about things God hasn't promised. So he's not surprised at all when his life is in danger. But more than that, he is ready at any point to be sacked or killed. And I think that is the one we may need most of all to hear. You see, this example, Daniel, he has the option just to bend slightly on quite a small thing. It's not wrong to pray indoors. It's not wrong to pray secretly. It's just 1 month. And if you do that, Daniel, you'd keep your job. You are the third most important man in the world. Think of all the good you could do if you hung on to that job. I wonder, are you sackable? Or will you hang on to your job no matter what? I wonder if the University Christian Union that you lead, I wonder if it would be possible for the student union to ask of you something that you wouldn't say yes to. How much do you really want to stay on campus to be able to book rooms? Or I wonder if there is something you'd say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. You're going to have to kick us out. And one of the painful joys of working at St. Helens, where I work, for the last 10 years, is that at St. Helens, we as clergy don't just sort of tell everybody else to do painful things in their workplace and in their campuses, but actually William has led us clergy to stand up to our bosses too in the Church of England. And sometimes that has been painful. It's nothing too drastic, I guess, but on the day that Claire and I drove to Cambridge to tell her parents where we were going to work, where my job was, that was pretty easy to explain because you open the Daily Telegraph, you turn over 2 pages, and there was William Taylor, the vicar of St. Helens, on the page because he had just refused to take his salary from the Archbishop of Canterbury as a protest against what the Archbishop was teaching. And these decisions come to us all. I assume you get them in your workplace. I assume you get them with your friends. And they come whether the people in power are nasty or nice. I wonder, are you ready for the day when prayer becomes a capital offence? I don't expect that to happen very soon, but I don't think Daniel was either. Again, we need to be careful. If your boss says, please stop saying grace loudly before the important lunches with the clients, it might be okay to pray quietly in your head. But if your boss says, we will have no God here, we don't do God in this classroom or in this office or in this government, then we may need to do whatever we would have done anyway, 3 times a day, and in public, and call their bluff, and trust God. Because our primary loyalty needs to be to our God. And how is that worth the risk? Well, it's worth the risk because of 5 verse 23 that we saw last week. See, even the scariest enemy only has breath because our God gives it to them. So our God is able to remove their power or their life at any point. There is no problem, even if they kill you. The hand that holds the sword could be made to drop it at any moment. And if they don't, that can only be because my death is part of God's plan. I wonder if we really believe that.
They only have breath to hold the knife or the affidavit in their hands because God wants to use them to achieve his purposes. Well, Daniel believed it. He threw away his position as prime minister of the world without the least clue of what God had planned. All he knew was his God. He didn't have a clue what the plan was. But I think that we can see. I think we can work out what God was doing in all of this. So come and see God accomplishing his plan through the 122 satraps and presidents. So point two is called How the King Responds. And what we learn here is what God, the true king, he's the king in the point there, what God, the true king, is like. And we're going to learn it by paying attention to Darius, the little king, and contrasting them. See, in verse 12, his whole cabinet has sprung their trap. Verse 12 is just so kind of oily and slimy, isn't it? O king, did you not sign a law?
Darius, yes, no, I did. Cannot be revoked, according to the laws of the Medes and Persians. He's very royal.
And they are laughing in their beards at him. And Daniel pays no attention to you. Do you see what they're doing? The king is new. He's in his first months in government. He's from way out east beyond Essex. He's a simple soldier. They're saying he's probably never been lied to before. We are the greatest civil service in the world. This is yes, minister, and Darius is trapped. And he's trapped between what he wants and his own law. That's the trap. He really, really wants to save Daniel. Verse 14, he's distressed, he sets his mind to deliver Daniel, he labored all day to rescue him. It seems that the 70-year-old Jew and the 62-year-old Mede have become friends in this city that is foreign to both of them. But his law says Daniel must die. And the counterstroke is brilliant, it's built in, verse 15, they're a bit less respectful now. They say, "No, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians, that no injunction or ordinance that the king established can be changed. It's so sorry, O king, but you are too powerful to do what you want. It cannot be done." And the comparison with God is obvious in the vocabulary that they use. Darius wants to deliver Daniel, but when he fails, he has to hope, verse 16, that Daniel's God will be able to deliver him. Deliver, deliver. Who can do it? Darius thought that maybe he'd have a go at being God for a month. But really, he is not up to the job at all. And I've put some of the big contrasts on the sheet. So Darius is very foolish. He can't see what his ministers are planning. But God will see. He can see hundreds of years into the future. Darius is tricked, caught out by events. But God controls everything, including this trickery. And the kings of Persia, they think they can write laws that can never be changed. What do you think about that idea? Isn't that a crazy, stupid sort of power to give to a human being? Even if you could find a human being who was not corrupt and didn't want to write laws that were just plain evil, you would still have the problem of their stupidity and their mistakes and not being able to tell the future and react to circumstances. You only want that power with somebody who can genuinely tell the end from the beginning, which I think, one last thing on the Pope, will be the test of Francis I's humility, won't you? That the papers have been so excited about. If he can give up the claim that popes can make infallible laws that can never be revoked, then maybe we can talk. It's an extraordinary thing to give a human being. See, only God is never embarrassed by what he's said in the past. But then big one, key one, bottom of the list, Darius cannot even save his most important, best-loved servant in his own palace, surrounded by his army, in his own capital city, when he has all day from his own pet lions. See, being saviour of the world is a lot harder than you'd think. It's a lot more kind of complicated ends that need to be tied down. Whereas God can deliver his people, wherever they are, from whatever comes. And we know that because behind everything in the book of Daniel, actually, is a law. Is a signed document, an injunction, the law of God. I've put them on the sheet, Jeremiah 25. We don't need to turn them, but you can look at them later. Jeremiah 25 says there'll be exiles for 70 years in Babylon, and then Israel is coming home. It was written when they first were taken away. In 70 years' time, you'll be back. We'll see you then. Whereas Isaiah 44 and 45 puts a name on it. It says that somebody called Cyrus is going to send you home. That's in a prophecy that there is still no convincing reason to date other than 200 years before. You can imagine how people have argued about that. Picking the name of the king 200 years in advance, the one who's going to send you home. That's the law that God has decided is irrevocable, that cannot be changed. But actually, in the background, God has the same problem as Darius. So the problem is the people of Israel are dreadful. So God has the same problem. What happens when you want to save people who break your own laws? That's why Daniel's there in Babylon. The people of God broke his laws so badly that he punished them with exile. But God wants to save them, it seems. That's his intention. So can God do what Darius can't? And just notice that is a personal question for all of us. If you're somebody who breaks God's rules but don't want to die and meet him unforgiven, then you really need to know, is God someone who can save people who break his laws? And the answer to that doesn't become clear until the death of Jesus. And I think probably we'd have need to talk about the death of Jesus anyway in this chapter from that question. But actually, God has put the answer, amazingly, in the chapter, in one more comparison. So just briefly, let's compare Daniel and Jesus. I wonder if there's an alarm bell ringing. Let me tell you, I really resisted seeing Daniel as an example of Jesus here. I'm very cautious about reading Jesus' life back into details of the Old Testament. We know the whole Bible is about Jesus. And we'll see next week, actually, the whole book of Daniel is explicitly, directly about Jesus. That's the point of the book. But that doesn't mean that everybody who has a bad day followed by a good day is having a death and resurrection experience. They might just have, you know, had some sleep or something in between. So I didn't want to see every detail as Jesus, but detail after detail after detail kept fitting into place. Daniel wouldn't have had a clue about actually his experience of being part of God's answer. But just for a bit of fun, let's just imagine Daniel a year after this event. So there's Daniel, he's 73 maybe, he's sitting in his room, he's having a lemonade, he's an old man, and he is thinking about the promises from 70 years ago. And he's wondering, how is it that God can keep his promise? How can he deliver sinful people? How can God keep his laws, which means punishing evil, and also deliver people, which means not promising them? And that Daniel sips his lemonade and says, I cannot think how God could do that. And as he's puzzling, he just looks around his room at the photos on his wall. And there's one. There he is being arrested because people were envious of his power and put up a trick and a trap with the king. But actually afterwards, there's the document from the king, verse 22, saying Daniel was blameless and innocent of all the charges. So an innocent man is arrested. And then there's Daniel being thrown in the pit. Nice photo of the lions. And he goes down into the pit to die. And they seal him into the place of death with a stone, a large stone rolled over the entrance. And then they seal it up with royal authority so that no one can tamper with it. That's a bit familiar. Then there's a photo of Daniel being raised up out of the pit. And he's not dead and he is vindicated and proved innocent. And do you know what? He is given the highest authority in the country. And I just cannot think how God is going to do this saving and saving the guilty and judging thing. I just cannot work out how he can do it. And anybody with a New Testament is like little Johnny in reception class, aren't they? So, miss, I know, it's Jesus. Jesus dies and he takes the punishment of guilty people. And that day too, there were stones and seals and trials and an innocent man was killed and then raised up and then vindicated. And we go free. Though it will be 500 years before little Johnny can give us the answer. And again, if you want to know more about that, the man who for 3 days went through something a bit like Daniel, and that God says that is the reason why anybody here can be forgiven of anything they've done, no matter what God thinks as against his law, he's found a way to forgive you. Well, I suggest that is the thing to talk to your neighbour about when we finish. Because even 500 years ago, we need to stay 500 years before Jesus, even then everybody can see that God is king and that God can deliver. Even if we can't work out till Jesus how, we can see both. And we can see that God sees their plan to trap his people and he kicks it into next week. So I want us just to enjoy the response from God to this evil plan. Just have a look at the contrast with Darius again. So Darius, he gets less and less happy And I think we get more and more anxious for the satraps and presidents because bear baiting and king teasing, they are both extreme sports, aren't they? The king of Babylon, he knows they tricked him. He wants to stop them, but they make him kill his best friends. Do they regret their plot yet? As the king cannot sleep and cannot eat because he's so worried. So just on a human level, you've done something very stupid. This is not going to go well for you. But actually, the poor, stupid, envious bureaucrats, because they're not just fighting one king, and they're fighting two kings. And you can catch Darius out, but you cannot catch God out. So the lions don't eat Daniel. That's a bit of a blow for their plan, isn't it? And they don't eat Daniel, though that isn't because they weren't hungry. Let's just see what happens when we put you in the den, verse 24. You get ripped to pieces before you even touch the ground, because the hungry lions have had to spend the whole night with five Michelin stars Daniel, 1 foot away, but God won't let them eat him. So they are crazy with hunger, and the plot has failed. But more than that, and their plot doesn't just fail. Their plot backfires amazingly, because it was God's plan all along. Daniel in the lion's den was always God's plan. God's law said, we're going to have to send God's people home. Well, how are we going to do that? We need some satraps, actually, to do something really stupid in order to be able to send God's people home. Let me see if I can just take you through what I think their plan achieves. Two things. One thing it does, it teaches the new administration in one night what it took Nebuchadnezzar decades to learn, the previous king. So verse 16, may your God save you, the king says. Verse 20, Daniel, servant of the living God, has he saved you? Verse 26, the new king is writing to all his people, just like Nebuchadnezzar years before, saying Daniel's God is the real God. Daniel's God is king. Now there's a useful thing for Darius and Cyrus to know, don't you think? As they begin deciding their religious policy in their new empire. That's a pretty good blow to have landed. Well done, the satraps. We really needed that. Thank you very much. But then second thing their plan does is it gets Daniel cemented in power inside the new administration for the crucial 3 years when all the laws get written about sending people home. And why is it, do you think, that God had given Daniel 66 years of training in governing an empire? Why was that a good idea? Because after Belshazzar falls and they're looking for somebody to help them out, you know, if only there was somebody who wasn't tainted by the previous administration but has real experience and loads of contacts and was kind of kicking around and able to help us govern the world. Oh, Daniel, how nice to meet you. That's good. But actually, if we're going to do something amazing like sending the Jewish people home, Daniel is going to need a completely free hand, because all sorts of people aren't going to like that. The people who they owe money to, the people who they're slaves to, people who've been working with them, the people whose land they're going to take when they go back. So what can we do that will take out the entire top tier of the administration and replace them all with Daniel loyalists? If only there was a way to make the king really hate them and pretty much force him to feed them all to the lions. If only we could find a way to do that. And as the dust clears after it all, who is left in exactly the right place at the right time? As Cyrus and his deputy Darius begin discussing what to do with all the tens of thousands of displaced people that Nebuchadnezzar has left all over the empire in the wrong places, and all the ragtag remnants of their religions tucked away in their treasure chambers, who is sitting next to them? Daniel. When they decide to repatriate every single displaced group from Turkey to India and to fund their return and rebuild their temples, who do you think drafted that law? Who said, oh no, I can write that up for you. Not a problem. Let's just make sure the Jews are in there. There we go. I'll do that for you, says Daniel. And you know, again, people thought the Bible had made that up. And there's no way an emperor would pay for groups of people to go home like that. Again, until we began finding evidence, they did it for everybody. So isn't this amazing extravagance from God? God has a few thousand Jewish people he needs to get home. He needs to put one city and one temple back together. And you'd think that was a really seriously hard thing to do, wouldn't you? And you'd be terrified when the 122 satraps are trying to oppose it and God's people. You'd think, oh no, God, it's all over. You can't possibly do this. But God makes this the policy of the entire world. Let's send everybody home. It's a great policy for the Medes and the Persians. It gets them loyalty and peace across the empire. But just think how much God has to do to get this done. If we'd had a video camera in the 530s BC, you'd see everybody, all their funny haircuts and their silly souvenirs from Babylon, they're all going home, brown people and white people and black people who speak any number of different languages. We don't know how many, maybe a million people trudging home with no idea that they are free to go home just because God made a law about one little group because God wanted his people back. Isn't our Father God superb? Isn't he superb? The enemies think they're being so clever with their unchangeable laws. Well, they are about to meet an unchangeable law. And weren't you there when Belshazzar tried to take on God? Idiots. Don't you know about the fiery furnace? That didn't work too well. They have no breath unless God gives it to them. And whatever they put me through, however painful, they work for God. When they arrest Daniel, and there's probably a copy of Jeremiah on his desk. We know from chapter 9, verse 2, that Daniel is reading Jeremiah that year. And maybe it's even open at chapter 25 when they kick the door down, do you think? In our day, it's the same, I think. Less dramatic, but the same. In our day, there are all sorts of people who really expected belief in God and the people of God to disappear in our generation. And that is, I think, what explains the anger of militant atheists. It's sort of, why are you people still here? Have you not gone away yet? They really thought they could eradicate the people of God. Not with lions, maybe, but they have tried by pushing God into the private sphere. Just like we said last week, they tried in the USSR. And they've tried replacing true religion with satisfying atheist alternatives. We haven't had much from Alain de Botton, do we, have about his Black Tower, but that's the idea. Which is exactly what the French Revolution tried. And they would love to do things like preventing Christians from treating their children like Christians and teaching them about Jesus. Richard Dawkins calls that child abuse to do that. They'd love to think of any way of getting rid of the people of God. Well, poor fools. And by all means, have a go. People have been trying to eradicate the people of God for 4,000 years. People with more executive authority and more sophisticated brains, and all they've ever managed to do is further God's plans. By all means, have a go. You work for him. You work for our gods. And Darius's conclusion is our main point, and actually the main point of chapters 3 to 6. So there's just under conclusion on your sheet. We'll finish there. God is the boss. That is the conclusion. Six of the key words in verse 26, verse 27 have been used about Darius or lions or Daniel's promotions, but really they are true about God. He is living and enduring. He has the kingdom. He has dominion, and he can deliver and rescue. God is the boss. And the whole first half of Daniel is structured just to prove that. That's on your sheet, the structure. Even for slow-witted Babylonians, we will do it twice. God is the boss. Even when you feel small and threatened, under persecution in Indonesia or Saudi Arabia or in a bank in the city or the staff room of a North London school, God is the boss. But I said this is really a book about Jesus. And that's what to come back for next week. Chapters 3 to 6 say who is the boss, and the rest of Daniel says what will the boss do? What's he going to do, this boss? What's his plan? Let me pray. Father God, we praise you that you are so stunningly in control of all world history. Father, please forgive us where we forget that in our small sphere in our lives in this small city here. Lord, please would we trust you with our history and our choices the way Daniel trusted you with his. And Lord, please would we see your glorious plan vindicated and your King Jesus praised above all other names. We ask this in his name. Amen.